From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
This is the only choice. Here you don't have multiple choices in order for you to choose one of them.
You have
two options. Either to have these prisoners or detainees remain in Israeli prisons, or to capture an Israeli soldier.
Today, an excerpt of a rare meeting between Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah and former U.S. ambassadors. We'll speak with one of the men who met with him, Ambassador Edward Peck. Then former Haitian Prime Minister Van Neptune has been freed after spending more than 2 years in prison. And we'll go to Chicago, where the city council has just approved a measure requiring Walmart and other companies to pay employees not the minimum wage, but a living wage. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Lebanese government says the death toll in the 2 weeks of Israeli bombing could be as high as 600. Earlier today, at least 11 Lebanese were killed in dozens of Israeli strikes on South Lebanon. The news comes as Israel's announced a massive call-up of up to 30,000 reserve troops. Israeli military radio told South Lebanon Thursday that Israeli forces, quote, will totally destroy any village from which missiles are fired toward Israel. Earlier this morning, we reached independent journalist Dar Jamal in Beirut.
The quote-unquote official death toll is far too low. I actually called down to a hospital in Sidon yesterday and spoke with a doctor there, and he said that he felt that the number should be at least adding 250 to that total at a minimum and likely double. The doctor told me that they are receiving countless people but in that hospital alone. But the problem was, just like here in South Beirut, there are so many buildings that have been utterly demolished with families inside that they just really don't, there's no way to get the bodies.
The destruction to Lebanese infrastructure continues. Israel bombed a field of radio and television relay stations belonging to Lebanon's state broadcaster. In the eastern Bekaa Valley, Israeli warplanes hit three trucks carrying food to Beirut. One driver was killed. It was at least the second attack on aid vehicles in as many days. On Wednesday, an Israeli warplane hit a truck carrying medical and food supplies donated to Lebanon by the United Arab Emirates. The driver and two others were killed. The strike came a week to the day Israel hit another truck carrying supplies from the Arab Emirates, also killing the driver. In Beirut, a resident spoke Thursday while touring the damage to his neighborhood.
What should I say? The destruction here expresses how civilized the Americans and the Israelis are. What you see here is a safe residential area. There are no militants here.
Meanwhile, photographs have emerged showing a Lebanese ambulance was bombed earlier this week, even though the vehicle is clearly marked as an emergency vehicle. The photos show the roof of the ambulance smashed and pockmarked. Robert Fisk of the London Independent writes, Israel's missiles pierce the very center of the Red Cross painted on the roof, raising speculation the pilots used the cross as a target. Meanwhile, Hezbollah fighters fired at least 110 rockets at Israeli border towns Thursday. No injuries were reported. Children continue to pay a heavy price in the attack on Lebanon, forced to take refuge in schools, mosques, shelters around the country. In Beirut, UNICEF Director for Emergency Programs Daniel Toole spoke on the crisis affecting Lebanon's children.
We estimate that at least 30% of the casualties, those dead, are children. That's a very high level. We estimate that probably 45% of the displaced are children because there are so many people on the move. That's a very, very high number, and it means that we have much higher rates of dependency on assistance in this beginning period.
Meanwhile, the Israeli military has admitted it has been using cluster bombs. Earlier this week, Human Rights Watch said Israel's shelling civilian areas with cluster bombs in violation of international law. Israel says it's used the weapons lawfully. In Beirut, Peter Buckert, Emergencies Director at Human Rights Watch, denounced Israel's stance.
It's very disturbing to see that Israel is using cluster bombs in populated areas, because we documented in Iraq and Kosovo the severe effect on the civilian population of the use of this very indiscriminate weapon.
Peter Bückert of Human Rights Watch. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to see and hear our full interview with Peter Bückert on Tuesday's show. Israeli airstrikes continue to kill Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, at least five on Thursday. The dead include a 75-year-old woman whose home was hit by an Israeli missile. Funerals have become a daily phenomenon there. Two young children and their mother were laid to rest Thursday. They were among the 24 Palestinians killed in Israeli strikes the day before. It was the highest single-day Palestinian death toll in 2 weeks. At least 149 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's month-long assault following the capture of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. On Thursday, Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh rejected the comments from Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas that a deal for Shalit's release is imminent.
يعني احنا من البدايه كنا في الحكومه الفلسطينيه قد طرحنا مبادره في واحده من بنودها.
The Palestinian government has said from the beginning the subject of the captured soldier should be solved on the basis of diplomatic negotiations and on the basis that there are 10,000 Palestinian prisoners suffering inside the Israeli prisons. We said that this issue should find a fair, just, and equal solution.
In other news, Israel's dismissed UN Secretary General Kofi Annan's call for a joint investigation into the deadly Israeli air bombing of the UN base in South Lebanon. The UN says it wants to be part of a probe into Tuesday's strike, which killed four international observers. Kofi Annan has accused Israel of deliberately attacking the base. According to UN officials, Israel was asked a dozen times to stop firing on the observers. In total, Israel launched more than 20 strikes around the base. The bombing continued even as rescuers tried to save the victims. Israel denies the attack was intentional. There is concern the bombing will lead to the withdrawal of international monitors and aid workers. On Thursday, the Australian government said it's withdrawing a dozen specialists who were helping with evacuation efforts in South Lebanon. Meanwhile, Israel has also ruled out major UN involvement in any possible international force in Lebanon. In a speech to an Israeli advocacy group on Thursday, Israel's ambassador to the UN, Dan Gillerman, said Israel would only accept, quote, an international professional force with soldiers from countries who have the training and capabilities to be effective. Speculations growing a possible international force would include U.S. troops. Harper's Magazine correspondent Ken Silverstein is reporting a highly placed former CIA officer says the Bush administration is considering deploying troops. According to the former officer, the proposal is meeting resistance from Pentagon officials who say the military is overstretched in Iraq and Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Israel's Justice Minister, Chaim Ramon, is drawing controversy for claiming the indecision at this week's conference in Rome means Israel has been given a green light to continue attacking Lebanon. European Union officials have rejected Ramon's statement. The talks broke down after the U.S. and Britain blocked an international effort for an immediate ceasefire. President Bush continues to dismiss ceasefire calls. Speaking at the White House Thursday, Bush also suggested Iran bore responsibility for the current conflict.
I believe this. I believe that, as Condi said yesterday, the Middle East is littered with, agreements that just didn't work. And now's the time to address the root cause of the problem. And the root cause of the problem is terrorist groups trying to stop the advance of democracies. Hezbollah attacked Israel. I know Hezbollah is connected to Iran. And now's the time for the world to confront this danger.
Meanwhile, Lebanese President Emil Lahoud criticized the U.S. government's support for Israel's continued bombing.
It was a huge disappointment. They should have called on an immediate ceasefire. Most Arab and European nations, who were silent at first, were now asking for a ceasefire. But unfortunately, the United States is supporting Israel until the very end and rejected that call.
In other news, al-Qaeda has released a new recording urging Muslims to attack Israel and its allies over the ongoing Israeli attacks on Lebanon and Gaza.
إن القذائف والصواريخ التي تمزق أجساد المسلمين في غزة ولبنان
On the tape, Al-Qaeda deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri says his group will not stand by while Israel attacks Lebanon and Gaza. Zawahiri also calls the world an open battlefield and says because Muslims are being attacked everywhere, Al-Qaeda will attack everywhere. It was the first Al-Qaeda statement to address Israel's attack on Lebanon. In news from Iraq, a series of rocket and mortar rounds struck a Shiite neighborhood in Baghdad Thursday. 31 people were killed and more than 150 wounded. In Haiti, former Prime Minister Yvonne Neptune has been freed after spending more than 2 years in prison. Neptune walked out of the national penitentiary on Thursday, frail and barely able to speak. He's been on a hunger strike for much of the past 15 months to protest his imprisonment. He was immediately taken to a hospital for treatment. Yvonne Neptune was jailed shortly after the 2004 coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was never charged with a crime and was the most high-profile political prisoner detained by the U.S.-backed interim government. We'll have more on Neptune's release later in the broadcast. This news from Europe. The Polish government is expressing concerns over a U.S. plan to establish a missile base that would be immune from Polish control. The Bush administration is insisting the proposed site be designated sovereign U.S. territory. Poland would have no legal authority over the base and would not be informed of U.S. missile tests. The base would be the sole European site to host the Bush administration's controversial missile defense program. Here in the United States, the UN Human Rights Committee called on the White House today to shut down all secret detention facilities and grant the International Committee of the Red Cross access to any detainees held in armed conflict. The committee says it has credible and uncontested information. The U.S. has detained prisoners, quote, secretly and in secret places for months and years. This news on a story we've been following. There are new developments in the growing internal battle over the American Psychological Association's support for the participation of psychologists in military interrogations. Salon.com is reporting 6 of the 10 people on the APA task force that drafted the psychologist policy have close military ties. 4 of the 6 worked at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, or Afghanistan. Dissident APA members say those task force members have a significant conflict of interest. The news comes as APA members prepare to discuss the issue at a conference next month. More than 1,300 APA members and outside psychologists have signed an online petition denouncing the APA's current stance. You can go to our website at democracynow.org and listen to, watch, or read the transcripts of our debate on the issue of the APA's involvement with military interrogations at Guantanamo and other prisons. In Colorado, a 75-year-old woman will begin a 10-day jail sentence today for taking part in an anti-war protest. Bonnie McCormick is one of a dozen activists calling themselves the No Blood for Oil 12. They were found guilty of trespassing after demonstrating outside a military recruitment office last November. McCormick is one of 5 defendants who chose to serve their sentences behind bars. 2 of the defendants say they'll hold a fast during their detentions. In other news, peace activist Cindy Sheehan is a new landowner in Crawford, Texas. Crawford's the site of President Bush's ranch, where he refused to meet with Sheehan almost 1 year ago. Cindy Sheehan says her new property will be used to host anti-war activities around the president's vacation next month. In business news, the oil conglomerate ExxonMobil has announced another record-breaking profit, $10.4 billion in this year's second quarter. The total is the second biggest ever reported by a U.S. company. In first place, Exxon's $10.7 billion in the fourth quarter of last year. In other news, National Security Agency whistleblower Russell Tice has been subpoenaed to testify before a federal grand jury. According to the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, 2 FBI agents served Tice the subpoena outside his home on Wednesday. Tice was one of the sources for the New York Times article that exposed the government's secret domestic surveillance programs. He also spoke out about the domestic wiretapping in a series of televised interviews, including here on Democracy Now! Tice is now accusing the government of trying to silence him. After being served the subpoena, he said, quote, "This latest action by the government is designed only for one purpose, to ensure that people who witness criminal action being committed by the government are intimidated into remaining silent." And finally, the New York Daily News is reporting in May 2002, President Bush signed a directive that granted the Environmental Protection Agency the power to classify information as secret. Critics are questioning the timing of the Bush order, saying it may be linked to the EPA's handling of the cleanup of Ground Zero. Joel Kupferman of the New York Environmental Law and Justice Project said, quote, "I think the rationale behind this was not to let people know what they were potentially exposed to." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers.
That's quite a story. Before we go on to our first main segment, Juan, about the New York Daily News, your newspaper exposing this memo.
Yes, actually, it was a presidential directive that, and the date for it was very strange, May 6th of 2002, because it came 2 days before the Environmental Protection Agency did a major about-face on Ground Zero cleanup. On May 8th of 2002, the agency announced that it was going to begin testing and cleaning up office buildings and residential buildings all around Ground Zero after months of many residents of the area complaining that there, no cleanup had been done. And there's some suspicion that perhaps the agency had done some testing, found that there was more contamination than they had believed, and then announced the project on May 8th, but may have then gotten the president to agree to allow them to classify information previous to that, so that the public would never know what exactly was going on. So it's going to be interesting as more information evolves. Obviously, this is a huge continuing story. The Daily News has been running a series of editorials now, blasting the EPA and the current mayor, Bloomberg, for not dealing with the growing number of people who are continuing to get sick and to die. Now, there have been four confirmed deaths of workers at the Ground Zero pile, police and emergency workers, as a result of illnesses contracted from exposures to toxins at Ground Zero. And the number appears to be growing.
Well, we'll continue to follow it. Also, your book, which came out several years ago, Fallout, predicted the number of people who are increasingly going to get sick.
Right. Well, I mean, I spent many months reporting on this and actually documenting how the EPA had not been forthcoming to the public and that there were many more dangers. And precisely what I did say in that book was that I was feared that years afterwards that we'd be seeing a huge rise in illnesses and deaths from people who either worked at the pile or who lived in the area around the Ground Zero. And now we're beginning to see exactly that happening.
Well, now we go from Ground Zero and 9/11 to Lebanon.
Well, today we begin with Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. Although the United States considers him to be the head of a terrorist organization, three former U.S. diplomats had a chance to meet with him this past February in Lebanon. The diplomats were members of a delegation organized by the Council for the National Interest. During the meeting, Nasrallah was asked about Hezbollah's strategy to free Lebanese prisoners being held in Israel. This was his response.
The only possible strategy is for you to have Israeli prisoners, soldiers as prisoners, and then you negotiate with the Israelis in order to have your prisoners. Here, this is the only choice. Here you don't have multiple choices in order for you to choose one of them. You have only choices. You have two options, either to have these prisoners or detainees remain in Israeli prisons, or to capture an Israeli soldier.
That was Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah. One of the retired diplomats who met with Nasrallah in February is Edward Peck. When we come back from our break, he joins us in studio. Edward Peck, former U.S. Chief of Mission in Iraq and ambassador to Mauritania. Stay with us. Thank you. from the Battle of Algiers here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn to one of the retired diplomats who met with Hassan Nasrallah in February, Edward Peck. He is the former U.S. chief of mission in Iraq and ambassador to Mauritania, served as the deputy director of the White House Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Ambassador Peck.
Thank you, ma'am.
It's good to have you with us. Can you describe this meeting you had with the head of Hezbollah in Lebanon? And then we'll talk about the content of what he had to say, because this was before the capture of the two soldiers, and he basically said this was the plan.
Well, we were out there as international election observers in Gaza for the election, and then we traveled elsewhere through the area to Israel, to the West Bank, to Jordan, Syria, and finally to Lebanon, where we met with Nasrallah. We had spoken already with senior officials in Egypt and for Hamas and Fatah and the presidents of Syria and Lebanon in an effort which the Council for the National Interest was sponsoring to get a feeling for the area, how it was at that time in January. It was interesting to meet with him because we had already met with leaders of Hamas and Fatah before and after the election was over in Palestine. And his point was a fairly simple one, I think. Talking to us, retired diplomats, Americans, his key concerns were essentially how to free his country from the domination which he perceived and how to go about, you know, building the nation up again despite all the things that had happened to it over the years. So it was a logical, reasonable presentation. No screaming, no shrieking, you know, just an educated, intelligent man talking about serious issues that he perceived. It was interesting in the sense that the projection of people like that in this country is of, you know, blood-soaked wackos, and there are some of those out there on all sides, but that certainly was not the case with him. He believes very strongly in what he's doing, which is something that you want to think about as you deal with him. Because he is intent on accomplishing the objectives that he believes are the right ones.
And this issue of using Israeli, captured Israeli soldiers to, in essence, trade for Lebanese prisoners is not unheard of. Actually, didn't Nasrallah negotiate a major prisoner release back in 2004?
Yes, and the Palestinians and the Israelis and the Lebanese, Hezbollah and Israelis, have negotiated prisoner exchanges before. As I think you're aware, the Israelis have been holding a number of Lebanese as prisoners that they kidnapped from Lebanon, which is one of the contentious issues, you know, that upsets the folks on the northern side of that border.
I mean, he was very clear, Nasrallah, saying the only possible strategy is to have Israeli prisoners and soldiers as prisoners, and then you negotiate in order to get your prisoners. This is the only choice. You don't have multiple choices in order for you to choose. You have the two options, either to have your detainees remain in Israeli prisons or to capture an Israeli soldier.
Yeah, and it's called a bargaining chip. It's kind of a demeaning phrase, but if you've got some and we've got some, then perhaps we can make an exchange. And that has indeed happened before. And one of the things that concerns me, of course, is that I am not convinced that it's the capture of those two soldiers which has provoked this horrific Israeli response. I believe they were looking for an excuse, and there it was. And this is what's happened since.
Well, let's go back to this videotape that we have gotten a copy of. During your meeting with Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, he also discussed the founding of Hezbollah.
In 1978,
you know that in the year 1978, the Israelis invaded South Lebanon. And the UN Security Council issued or passed the resolution 425. They requested that the Israeli forces immediately withdraw from South Lebanon. And the Israelis did not.
بل في سنة 1982
on the contrary, in the year 1982
اجتاحوا المزيد من الأراضي اللبنانية
they invaded more Lebanese territories
واحتلوا العاصمة بيروت.
They even occupied the capital Beirut.
يعني سيد شارون كان وزير الدفاع وقت.
Mr. Sharon was the defense minister then.
من 78 ل 82 لسنة 2000 لم يفعل المجتمع الدولي شيئا لإخراج إسرائيل من لبنان.
Between 1978-1982 up till the year 2000, the international community did nothing to have the Israeli occupation forces out of Lebanon.
ولم يفعل شيئا لمنع اعتداءاتها للبنان.
Nor did it, meaning the international community, do anything to prevent its aggressions on Lebanon.
كان في قرار اسمه 425.
There was a resolution called 425.
كان محطوط من.
But it was put on the shelf.
نحن اللبنانيين توكلنا لمصيرنا.
We as Lebanese were left to face our fate.
لبنان بلد صغير.
Lebanon is a small country.
ضعيف.
Weak.
جيش وقدراته متواضعة.
Very humble army, with an army with very humble capabilities.
والأسوأ من هيك إنه كمان شعبه ممزق بسبب الحرب الأهلية.
What is worse is that the people is torn as a result of the civil war.
في مقابل أو في قبضة أقوى جيش في منطقة شرق الأوسط.
And facing the strongest army in the Middle East, meaning the Israeli army.
ليس فقط المجتمع الدولي بالتحديد أمريكا لم يفعلوا شيئا.
Not only the international community and specifically the U.S. administration did nothing.
حتى مثلا جامعة الدول العربية.
There is also the Arab League.
منظمة المؤتمر الإسلامي.
The OIC, Organization of Islamic Countries.
ما حدا كان يعمل شيء.
Nobody did anything.
نحن مجموعة شباب لبنانيين. أخذنا قرار إنه بدنا نقاوم الاحتلال.
We are a group of Lebanese youth. We took the decision that we need to confront and resist the occupation.
المقاومة التي أنشأناها نحن.
The resistance which we have established.
عندما بدأنا بها.
When we started with it.
كانت عمر أنا كان عمري 28 سنة.
I was our ages. It's talking about the ages of the young men who took part in this. I was 22 years old then.
أكبر شخص فينا كان عمره 27 سنة.
The oldest among us was 27 years old.
لأنه اللي كانوا فوق 30 سنة.
Because those who were over 30 then.
كانوا بيعتقدوا أنه لا يمكن الحق الهزيمة بإسرائيل.
Believed that it was impossible to defeat Israel.
كانوا بيعتبروا أنفسهم عقلاء.
They viewed themselves as sage, as wise people.
نحن كانوا يعتبرونا شباب مجانين.
And they viewed us or considered us as the crazy youth.
Hezbollah founder Hassan Nasrallah speaking with a group of, or leader, not founder, speaking with a group of U.S. diplomats, including Ambassador Edward Peck, who joins us in our studio in Washington. Juan?
Well, Ambassador, he mentions there this UN Resolution 425, which obviously has is almost ancient history, forgotten in the current crisis. But Israel is constantly mentioning UN Resolution 1559.
Yeah.
And there are some, including Hezbollah, who believe that that resolution doesn't really apply to Hezbollah per se. Could you explain that and the differences of opinion about even this latest resolution?
Well, let me start with saying that people in the Middle East, for obvious reasons, find it sort of ironic that Israel is now insisting on the implementation of 1559, whereas, as Nasrallah said, they ignored this earlier Security Council resolution demanding that they remove themselves from South Lebanon for 20 years. That's called selective morality. Everybody practices that, but it kind of cuts the ground out from under your stance if you think that only certain Security Council resolutions should be enforced. Hezbollah, the problem we face, the problem the Lebanese government faces, is that Hezbollah is a political party, as you're aware, that does a lot of things in the humanitarian and social field, which is good, and does some things in the military field, which certain people consider to be not good. And the Lebanese government, which is weak and riven, as you know, by the many, many sectarian groups and the differences that they have religiously and socially, is in no position whatsoever to take on Hezbollah. That would be a civil war. And while Israel does not mind necessarily seeing that happen, would like very much to have Hezbollah go away, there's no way in the world, as far as I can tell, that the Lebanese would even consider undertaking this. And this was made clear to us by the leaders of the Lebanese government with whom we also met on that trip.
Ambassador Peck, did you have any inkling when you met with Nasrallah after talking to him that something was imminent, that some kind of action was going to be taken?
No, ma'am. Certainly not from that meeting, but those of us who have lived in and worked on that part of the world for a long time, well, for any length of time, recognize that eventually there's going to be some kind of an explosion, to use the phrase correctly, because the situations like that, just they're rumbling. They're like, you know, semi-nascent volcanic eruptions. Something is going to happen, but certainly there was no indication at that moment that I detected, nor my colleagues either, that something like this was going to transpire. And it's worthwhile noticing, by the way, that the what some people call the disproportionality of the Israeli reaction. If I could, I have a piece of paper here I would like to quote from, if I may, because this discussion comes up so many times. In 1985, when I was the deputy director of the Reagan White House Task Force on Terrorism, they asked us, this is a cabinet task force on terrorism, I was the deputy director of the working group, they asked us to come up with a definition of terrorism that could be used throughout the government. We produced about six, and each and every case they were rejected because careful reading would indicate that our own country had been involved in some of those activities. After the task force concluded its work, Congress got into it, and you can Google into U.S. Code Title 18, Section 2331, and read the U.S. definition of terrorism. And one of them in here says one of the terms international terrorism means activities that, I quote, appear to be intended to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. Yes, well, certainly you can think of a number of countries that have been involved in such activities. Ours is one of them. Israel is another. And so the terrorist, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. And I think it's useful for people who discuss that phrase to remember that Israel was founded by terrorist organizations and terrorist leaders, Menachem Begin, who became statesmen and went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize. And Nasrallah may not be the same kind of guy, but his intentions are the same. He wants to free his country from domination by another.
I wanted to go back to the videotape. Nasrallah also mentioned an event that's back in the news this week, and that's Israel's bombing of a UN observation post in the southern Lebanese town of Qana in 1996. In that attack, 10 years ago, about 106 refugees were killed.
Between the years 1985 and the year 2000, we went on with the resistance. There was, for example, the Qana massacre. You heard about that. And the UN Security Council did not condemn the Qana massacre due to the US veto. In other words, our experience with the international community, first, it does not protect us. Meaning it does not prevent Israeli aggressions on Lebanon. And even after the aggression takes place, they do not even condemn the aggressor. On the contrary, they condemn the victim. And regard those who defend themselves as terrorists.
Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah speaking with U.S. diplomats in February, among them Ambassador Edward Peck, who is the former deputy director of White House Task Force on Terrorism in the Reagan administration, joining us in Washington. You were meeting with Nasrallah as, of course, the occupation and the war in Iraq continued. What effect was that having on him? How did he describe that?
I don't remember directly, but one of the things that we spoke, I have to tell you that we spoke to so many interesting people, interesting in the sense of having things to say that we needed to hear, that I would have to remind myself. But I think it's important for Americans to try to understand that those dots are connected. There is, in the minds of the people in that part of the world, at the very minimum, a connection between Palestine, West Bank and Gaza, and Lebanon, and Iraq, and Afghanistan, and the threats against Syria and Iran. And Nasrallah, who is an educated man, is certainly aware that these things are indeed linked. And he probably, and I'm open to correction, he probably implied that there was a direct connection between what America is involved in Iraq, and the American concerns with the security and safety of Israel at any cost.
And in your opinion, as a veteran, a diplomat, what is the impact of these United States actions in the world at large, especially in the Arab world? How is our standing in the eyes of the Arab world developing in these, especially now in this latest Lebanon situation?
Well, the latest situation is merely, you know, further indications of the sorts of things that they had already come to believe. There are facts, and there are facts, and then there are perceptions, and perceptions are the only reality. And the perceptions in the minds of an awful lot of people in the Arab world, in Europe and elsewhere, reflects the loss of American prestige, credibility, respect, as we go on doing things which seem in the eyes of others to be irrational and unjustifiable. And now when we have stepped up and say, you know, the first thing that you do in any struggle anywhere in the world is try to get a ceasefire so you can work on solving or trying to solve underlying problems. And when the United States says, no ceasefire, let's let them go on, you know, bombing and killing, I think the damage to us is not only vital, I think it is going to have a lasting effect on our relations with the rest of the world, commercially, socially, culturally, in every way imaginable.
Ambassador Peck, the way the Western media deals with al-Qaeda, with Hamas, with Hezbollah is linking, is sort of basically massing them all together. You've been meeting with people individually. What is your sense? I mean, the latest news, al-Qaeda releasing a new recording urging Muslims to attack Israel and its allies over the ongoing attacks in Lebanon and Gaza. What is your sense of where they agree and disagree and how much they work together?
I guess it's the sort of thing that you could see. It's a clumsy analogy. But it's the sort of thing where Democrats and Republicans will work together towards the achievement of an objective that they both see desirable. And as soon as that is over, they'll go back to squabbling again. And I think that that's the sort of thing that applies with any political, economic, military operation. So that Hezbollah and Hamas, which are from different sects, different sections of Islam, are perfectly prepared, for example, to take money and arms if they can get them from Iran. But they have no desire, certainly in the case of Hamas, to become a Shiite-dominated fundamentalist government. It's in the same way that we provide arms and money and so forth to Israel, but Israel certainly does not do our bidding, as we've seen many times, especially since we don't ask them to do much. The linkage of America with Israel with this perceived war on Islam is, to me, deeply concerning, because history has shown that you can build tremendous pressures of that kind, especially in societies which tend to be less developed than our own, which tend to be less well-educated than our own in many cases, and which become, you know, they're more traditional than we are. And you can generate an awful lot of anger and resentment, which we have succeeded in doing.
Ambassador Peck, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Former ambassador to Mauritania.
Sorry to talk so long.
No, thank you very much for speaking with us from Washington, former White House Task Force Deputy Director on Terrorism in the Reagan administration. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, Haiti's former Prime Minister, Yvonne Neptune, has been freed after spending more than 2 years in prison. On Thursday, Neptune walked out of the national penitentiary. Two UN peacekeepers then helped him into an ambulance that took him to a hospital. He was frail and barely able to speak. He has been on a hunger strike for much of the past 15 months to protest his imprisonment. Supporters and relatives celebrated his release. This is Yvonne Neptune's cousin, Marie Josette.
Finally, justice prevailed. I am very happy. For 15 months, he has been without food. He is drinking only water and was taking vitamins.
Yvonne Neptune was jailed shortly after the 2004 coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He was never charged with a crime and was the most high-profile political prisoner detained by the U.S.-backed interim government. His release comes less than 2 weeks after over 3,000 people marched in Port-au-Prince calling for the return of Aristide and the release of all political prisoners. Many of the demonstrators were members of Aristide's Lavalas party.
Patrick Ailey joins us now on the line from Port-au-Prince. He is the former defense minister in Haiti, as well as anti-drug czar, and he campaigned for the release of Yvonne Neptune. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Patrick Ailey.
Thank you for the invitation.
How did you get Yvonne Neptune out of prison? What is his condition? What is he saying?
Well, I think that, you know, the liberation of Yvonne Neptune is a result of his own a very courageous fight for justice. It's the result of the last election, and it's the result of the pressure that lately has been put on the legitimate government to act on this. Mr. Neptune is, as you might guess, a very weak physically, but I think that, you know, his morale is high, and also he has not lost his bearings, you know, as his fight against injustice is concerned. His first concern when they came to announce his liberation was for the other, the 1,000 other political prisoners.
And Patrick, what about the situation with President Aristide? Is there any indication, because I know the demonstration also called for the return of President Aristide, any indication that the new government is considering allowing him to come back to the country?
First of all, you know, I heard you mention that I think I heard 3,000 people. It was more like 30,000 people who took to the street with the demand that President Aristide come back to the country. Now, it's not only a matter for the current government to allow President Aristide to come back. On that issue, Mr. Preval has been very clear. But now, something should be actively undertaken to address the issue and also to make sure that when President Aristide comes back, his security and his a freedom of movement will be guaranteed. So, you know, let's not make believe that it is going to be an easy matter. We know that President Aristide ouster was organized by very powerful forces, including within the U.S. and in Haiti proper. So it is something that is going to require some active work by the current government.
What is the relationship between René Préval, the current president, and Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and also these other political prisoners, like the famous singer, the Haitian singer Soane? Will she be released?
We will keep on the pressure for her to be released because, you know, if that could be, Soane's case is even more scandalous than that of Yvonne Neptune, because Neptune was arrested on an arrest warrant, you know, flawed and as it was, whereas Soane was arrested in the dead of night by U.S. Marines, you know, which had no legal mandate to operate such an arrest. And she's been in jail for even longer than Mr. Neptune, and the charges are preposterous. You know, they've ranged from as you know, squashing a baby in a mortar and pestle, which was so ridiculous that, of course, nobody could consider that. And now she's accused of being involved, I believe, in the affair at the university back on December 5th, 2003. And, of course, these accusations are so shallow that the prosecutor himself has asked for them to be dropped, but obviously other people are pulling strings so that the process be dragged on. But now the group that initiated the last campaign for the release of Mr. Neptune is going to get on the case of Soane to secure a release, and we hope that these high-profile prisoners will help spring loose the anonymous one, the one that comes from the popular neighborhood and who have almost no backing in their fight against injustice.
And Yvonne Neptune's health right now, only speaking in a whisper in the hospital?
Yes. And, you know, it's no wonder. The man has been only drinking water with sugar and vitamins, and you know you cannot survive, really. You can survive, but you cannot thrive on such a diet. So he is very weak. We are waiting for a medical assessment, but obviously the first task at hand for him is to regain some of his forces so that he becomes more efficient in this next step in the fight that he's waging against injustice.
Patrick Ailey, we want to thank you for joining us from Port-au-Prince, former defense minister under President Aristide and former anti-drug czar, one of those who worked to get the former prime minister, Yvonne Neptune, freed. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we move on now to the last segment of today's broadcast in Chicago.
Well, on Wednesday, Chicago City Council approved a groundbreaking measure requiring large retailers to pay employees a living wage. Retailers with over $1 billion in sales will be required to pay workers at least $10 an hour, plus $3 in benefits by the year 2010. The vote makes Chicago the largest city with such a rule. The measure passed 35-14, despite opposition from Chicago Mayor Richard Daley and threats from retail giants like Walmart and Target that they would focus attention on suburban locations if the measure was approved. The passage of the Chicago ordinance comes a week after a federal judge struck down a measure in Maryland that would have forced Walmart to pay more for health care for its employees. It also comes on the heels of Congress's rejection earlier this month of a proposal to increase the federal minimum wage from $5.15 an hour.
Two guests join us now in Chicago, Alderman Joe Moore, chief sponsor of the measure, and Shireen Radigan, a field organizer with the community group ACORN that campaigned for the bill. I'd also like to mention we invited a representative from the Illinois Retail Merchants Association to join us, but they declined our request. We also invited Walmart on to join in this discussion. Walmart did send us a statement that read in part, quote, "This vote sends a message that Chicago is closed for business, closed for development, and closed for job creation." Alderman Joe Moore, your response.
Well, it's great to be here. And last Wednesday, Chicago City Council gave hope to over 10,000 employees of these big box retailers, hope for a better future. It is absolutely unconscionable that you can work a full day at a job, try to play by the rules, and yet still be in poverty. And what this ordinance is designed to do is to lift these employees out of poverty and give them a hope for a better future.
And Shireen Radigan, could you talk about the campaign that you developed in Chicago to be able to pass this legislation?
Absolutely. We were in the field. We were talking to communities and just wondering what their consensus was and allowing them, giving them the opportunity to get in touch with their local officials. So it was amazing to see the response from people. They were really excited to find out what was going on. A lot of people would come to us and ask us what's going on and can they get involved. So it was overwhelming. It was a good time.
But there were a lot of forces arrayed against you. Can you talk about how this began? I mean, this is definitely precedent-setting in the country, the largest city to pass a living wage ordinance.
Absolutely. There were a lot of oppositions. There were people from churches, community groups that got together, and a lot of times when we would go to these places and find out why they were opposing, just for, you know, our own information, a lot of people were told that they were going to get jobs coming to the rallies. A lot of people were told they would be paid to come to the rallies. So it was interesting to talk to people that were against the big box living wage because they had no idea what was going on. And once we actually sat down and got to know people that were opposing us and told them what the ordinance actually was about, they were surprised and felt really betrayed and used.
Well, you know, Walmart just poured literally millions of dollars.
Absolutely.
We had the newspaper editorial boards, Retail Merchants Association, the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, and Walmart, that was backed by large full-page ads, plus organizing some of the ministers on the city's south and west sides, convincing them that somehow this would end up being a job loser. Well, the bottom line is the experience of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and San Francisco, California, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Washington, D.C., all of which have passed living wage ordinances where the living wage is higher than the respective state minimum wages or the federal minimum wage, is that, in fact, the opposite has been true. There's been greater job creation, greater economic growth, because when you give people a little bit of additional dollars in order to survive, they spend that money in the local pharmacies and the local grocery stores and the other local businesses, thereby putting more dollars in the local economy and creating more jobs.
Alderman Moore, didn't the companies also try to make special appeals to the black community and black leaders? Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. There was a real concerted and really, quite frankly, appalling effort to try to divide and conquer the African-American community, to make this a racial issue. Fortunately, people didn't fall into that trap. And this ordinance had support across the board in the city council from every region of the city. African-American aldermen, Hispanic aldermen, white aldermen joined together in support of this ordinance. And this was also backed by polls, objective polls done in the city that showed overwhelming support among the populace on the north side, the south side, and the west side of the city of Chicago across all racial and economic boundaries. This is an absolutely very popular ordinance, and it's popular because people realize that the federal government is not going to do anything, at least in the near future, to raise the minimum wage, and it's absolutely appalling that it's as low as it is.
Joe Moore, why was the mayor, Mayor Richard Daley, opposed?
Well, the mayor is concerned about, he bought the arguments about the job loss. He is a conservative Democrat. I'm sure his opposition was sincere, but quite frankly, he was wrong on this issue. I urged him to look at the experience of other cities to see that this has not been bad economically for the other cities that have adopted living wages, and in fact has been very good and has helped in the long run create more jobs and more economic opportunity for people.
And Sharon Radigan, the ACORN has been conducting this campaign with other groups around the country on living wage bill. And while the Republicans in Congress have previously vetoed a raise of the minimum wage, there are indications now, at least a report in the New York Times today, that they may be reconsidering that and that moderate Republicans may get a vote in the House, bring it to the floor at least for an actual vote on raising the federal minimum wage. How big an issue has this become nationwide in working class communities?
Well, I think the federal minimum wage is, you'd have to have two jobs in order to sustain yourself. That, of course, should be raised. And I also think on the state level, because each state has their own needs, the minimum wage should be raised as well. It's ridiculous to say that $5.15 is enough to sustain a family. Even yourself, you would make under poverty. And below the poverty line. And so what I think really what this ordinance and a living wage suggest is that you need enough money in order to sustain yourself, in order to have the things you need in life, to afford gas. And especially, I know gas prices have been talked about a lot, and we've been discussing that a lot amongst each other, but in order to fill up your car, you'd have to almost virtually work a full day. And if that's your transportation source, then a lot of your income is going towards gas for your car, even.
Shireen, I wanted to ask you a question about Walmart's comment that it said that this means the vote sends a message that Chicago's closed for business, closed for development, closed for job creation, and this whole division of the black community and how you as an organizer dealt with this. Walmart warning it would focus its attention on suburban locations if the measure was approved, and as the alderman was saying, dividing the black leadership, saying with the box stores saying, like Target, we will build stores in black communities. It'll give jobs. And on the other hand, now Chicago saying that they're going to move to the suburbs. Do you believe this?
Oh, no, not at all. The suburbs are saturated. They're so full with what they need to do is they want to increase profit. And if you stick a Walmart right next to another Walmart, you're just going to divide the profits. They need Chicago. They absolutely need Chicago. The largest grossing Target in the United States is on Elston in Chicago. So they know the money's here. That is just, for me, I think it's just a ploy to get us to accept slave wages, in my opinion.
I don't believe that at all.
The big box retailers have saturated the suburban markets and the retail markets. In order to remain profitable, they have to expand. And the urban core provides a wonderful opportunity for all these big box retailers. We have a Target store in the city of Chicago that is the most profitable Target anywhere in the nation. Again, another appalling argument on the part of Walmart in particular, and that is that we're not going to move into the African-American community. But where have they been for the last 20 years, 30 years, when there hasn't been a living wage, and they've ignored that community? It's time to stand up and make sure that everyone has a living wage.
Joe Moore and Shireen Radigan, want to thank you both very much for being with us, Alderman and organizer with ACORN. That does it for today's broadcast. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!